Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. That's Black Market by the Weather Report. Erto Morea of the Weather Report, born on this day in 1941. What you're about to hear is a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. A dear friend of mine, Louisa Nielsen, forwarded me this article by Dr. Peter Weibrow called Dangerously Addictive, and I was just fascinated by it, and then got his book called American Mania, When More Is Not Enough, and his second book is The Intuitive Mind, Common Sense for the Common Good, which will be published next year. And this article that I read came out of the Chronicle for Higher Education, arguing that humans are ill-suited to a lifestyle of consumerism and ill-suited to the world we live in. Maybe we're just basically paleolithic creatures trapped in this modern world. He's also director of the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior at the University of California, Los Angeles, and is a physician. And Peter Weibrow, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. Let's just start. The article that caught my attention before I even picked up your book was you're saying things that some people have tried to say over the years, but not as effectively, I think.
Well, thank you.
And talk a bit about the concept that I threw out there, and if it is even close to it, which is that we're basically all paleolithic creatures stuck in a technological world and we don't know how to live in it.
Well, I think that's a good précis of what I said exactly. I think actually we are pretty paleolithic. The interesting thing about the human brain is that it has evolved over many millions of years, but what makes it human is really only a couple of hundred years old, actually 100,000 years old. It's we all grew up in Africa, and it was peculiar that through just a couple of strange happenings, we developed a frontal cortex which is capable of long-term planning and abstract thinking. But fundamentally, we still are creatures of immediacy. You know, as your previous guest was speaking about, and I was privileged to listen to her a little bit, Wangari Maathai. I think she was saying much the same as I am, only it's a different continent. That mm-hmm. In fact, there are a lot of people in her world at the moment who are seeking self-interest, and of course that's exactly what happens to us because it's instinctual and we drive for the immediate pleasure. And it doesn't matter whether you're doing that by becoming a member of parliament in an African country or whether you're doing that by becoming a CEO of a large company. The problem is that the balance of human behavior, which must offset this instinctual drive, which is, my statement is not that that's bad, it's just that one needs a balance to it, and that balance is in fact social behavior and social interaction, which moderates the pleasure and the instinct by essentially bringing you back to the reality of your social circumstance. And that, of course, was true when we all lived in small communities in Europe and then in the U.S., and it's true. I'm sure it was true in Africa and probably still is, living in small communities which have been broken up by our modern life, both there and in the U.S.
What you're talking about there, I'd like to lead to in just a second, which is your conversation about Adam Smith and how he may have been right on some levels, but our society has gone so far beyond what he thought we could that it's mm-hmm. turned us upside down. But I want to go back to the very beginning just for a moment because you started in a very humorous way, which I like. Your article was started with a quote by George Carlin.
Yes, one of my favorites, actually.
He says, you write, it's called the American dream. George Carlin lamented shortly before his death last year, because you have to be asleep to believe it. Too bad for the rest of us that Carlin and his signature satire haven't been around for the wake-up call for the current market meltdown.
Right. It's true. I mean, his daughter, who is making a film about the American dream, gave me that quote. And if you look him up on the web, you'll find that just before he died, he had a whole series of presentations in which he quite pithily pointed out that If you stand back and you use the rational mind, which is this most recently evolved mind that I was talking about, what we sometimes call the executive mind, it is in fact very clear that we're doing things which are self-destructive, but we're doing them in terms of the short-term gain. I give you an example. I was at dinner a week or so ago with some friends at a very nice little local bistro, and he's a fun fellow who runs it, so we had a good dinner and we all were quite content, and three of us, and we're just about to leave, and he likes us, so he suddenly turned up. He's from Canada and from Montreal and French and speaks very, you know, like a Frenchman. And he comes in and he says, don't go, I have a new tiramisu from Montreal, you must try it. So we're sitting there, and we're all quite content, but he brings this slab of tiramisu, and of course in 10 seconds it had disappeared, because we cannot. There's a whole bunch of research that shows this, that when you're presented with something that is abstract, and you say, well, would you prefer $10 now or $100 in a week? Most people will say, I prefer $100 in a week, or to translate it to the tiramisu, would you like a small piece now or a cake, a big piece later on? Most people will say, I'll wait. But when it's in front of you, you can't wait. And this is the whole dilemma of the human frailty, that we somehow have to grasp that abundance in this country, it's a different issue in Africa, but abundance, where we have, you know, 1,259 hair treatments to choose from in the grocery store, it's a nightmare. You know, we don't know what to do, and so we indulge our sense of curiosity and self-interest, and through that try to climb up the social ladder, whereas in fact we should be thinking about what we do interactively rather than personally and selfishly.
I'm curious about, for you, the intersection of all this. I mean, you write about, as you do in your book, the workings of the brain and how the brain evolved from our reptilian brain to what we have now, and how they work together. And then you kind of very neatly pull in Adam Smith, who was kind of the father of capitalism, for want of a better term, but that something then went awry. I mean, if things were working on some levels for a long time, something has happened to dangle. We used to have to find fruit trees, but now we have candy in front of us 24 hours a day.
Well, I was going to say that the interesting thing about Smith is that, of course, he's held up as being the person who quantified our present market system, which we call capitalism, which is just an evolution, really, of what we've done for many thousands of years. If you look back into the history of the human race, in fact, even if you go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, as I did a month or so ago, they have an exhibit called Beyond Babylon. And Babylon was a market society just like we are. It didn't have Adam Smith to codify it. What Smith said simply was that if you think of society as a balance, on one side, what drives the market is self-interest, curiosity, and social ambition. They're the engines of the market. And he knew that human beings were greedy. I mean, in the 18th century, when he was writing, everybody knew that the human being was greedy, and they were afraid that when the church lost its grip, which it was doing, the Roman Catholic Church in Europe, everybody said, well, we're all going to run to the dogs and it'll be a mess. And what Smith argued, and some others argued, is that no, because we live in small communities, we'll actually pay attention to each other, and we won't let the vagabonds get away with everything. We'll keep them in check. And in fact, if people put their local capital, their own resources, into a community, and they are there with others also putting local resources into the community, then there will be a natural balance, what he called the invisible hand. And this indeed works out. If you have small internet communities where interconnected, I suppose internet is rather a different word these days, but interconnected communities, what happens is that people monitor each other, and they, you know, if the fellow who makes shoes down the streets uses inferior leather, then after a while nobody buys his shoes. So his own capital is in that business, so he's mindful of the fact that he needs to do a good job. And when you see a system like that, that is a balanced market society, which Smith argued was self-regulating, and therefore you didn't need government to get in the way. And there are a few frills and whistles we can put on there, but just for the sake of this discussion, that's basically the principle. Then you fast forward, you know, and you find that the instinctual side, especially in trickle-down Reaganomics and Thatcherism in England, is in fact still using the same engine. It's self-interest, curiosity, and social ambition. Whereas on the other side, the community aspects of things have tended to fall apart. We don't live in the same communities as we used to. Government regulation then takes that over, but government regulation is a much more blunt instrument than the nuance of knowing your friends and doing things which you don't want to be shamed for, but you want to feel proud of, and so on. You get the idea.
So, but I wonder on a couple levels here. One is that whether the very nature of the market system itself can ever accomplish for what Adam Smith set out to do, given our predisposition as human beings to want more when it's in front of us, and being greedy, it's the nature of humankind to kind of stuff itself for the winter, however we play that out.
Mm-hmm.
That then, and if the nature of the marketplace also is to gobble up smaller markets and grow, which is done now exponentially, and then the technology added on that has made it so connected and interactive all the time that we can never get away from anything. That whether or not that vision works in the 21st century, and how that changes.
No, you're absolutely right. It's a conundrum. I mean, it's a big problem. And I think this is what we've got to put our best minds to thinking about and to figuring out how it can be, how the best of the market system can be sustained, and how at the same time we can build a stronger infrastructure. You know, the whole issue is really how do we develop a society with sustainable wealth? And unfortunately, we tend to interpret wealth in a material context, where, of course, wealth is much more than just materialism. If you think of it, you're broadcasting out of the East, and there were many states in the East that started with the name the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, mm-hmm. etc.
Mm-hmm.
That was a significant word because it meant that not only did you vote collectively, but you also held in common certain things which had to be there in order to form a platform for the opportunity for capital markets to work properly. You had to have, for example, security. You have to have a set of rules where you're not going to run off with somebody else's treasure when they put it in your business, etc. So these types of covenants, which we all have and we get used to in a country like this where we have freedom of expression and so on, these things are very, very important, and that part of the Commonwealth. But there's another part of the Commonwealth too, which is an educational system which enables us to move through the social hierarchy based upon talent. We think we have that here, but unfortunately we no longer do. It's the same with healthcare. That contains people in ways which are actually quite significant when it comes to enabling them to move easily through the social order. So this type of commonwealth has to be thought through, but then the real problem comes, how do you sustain something like that when you have to build some material wealth which is tied to the market? So it becomes an extremely complex issue, and unfortunately we tend to radicalize it. You know, we tend to say, oh, Obama's a socialist because he wants to bring in healthcare.
Right.
He's a tyrant. He's the new Black Caesar, you know, who's a tyrant. Well, the alternative interpretation of that is that he's using his, to use a technical term, his lateral prefrontal cortex, which is this piece of the brain which we inherited recently. He's using that in a thoughtful, planning way to bring up questions about how do we develop a sustainable society which both has the capacity to develop a material infrastructure which will support us, because that's very important. You know, it's not an issue of doing away with local entrepreneurship and having central planning. They tried that in Russia, and that didn't work. But on the other hand, we need to have a balance between that local entrepreneurship and, as you point out, especially as it tends in the competitive world of markets to become centralized and then much less local and much less open to control, we have to have something that helps regulate that and creates this other wealth, which is the social infrastructure. And it's not just social in the sense of, you know, everybody having a welfare check. Mm-hmm. It's bridges that work, it's schools that work, it's health systems that work. And although we don't like to do it in this country, actually there are some elements of Europe which have gone further down the road of solving this problem than we have. And, of course, we've convinced ourselves that we've created the best civilization the world has ever known, so we can't look anywhere else for help.
Of course not.
Which is a problem. But if you get my drift, it's really, and you can roll this back into, and that's a wonderful thing about neuroscience now, you can see why this is happening. Smith understood it from the behavioral standpoint, but now what has happened is we've validated it from the neurobiological standpoint, because he was right.
And I'm going to get to that.
But he was wrong.
Oh, I'm sorry, Peter. Yeah. I need to jump in there.
No, I'm chattering on.
No, it's fine. It's radio. You're supposed to chatter on. Dr. Peter Weibrow is with us. We discovered him in an article written for the Chronicle of Higher Education called Dangerously Addictive, Why We Are Biologically Ill-Suited to the Riches of Modern America. And his book then, American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. Dr. Weibrow joins us from California. The number here is 410-319-8888. Before we go to our first caller, who is from New York, let me ask you to kind of expound what you're about to go to here for a moment, which is this idea, when you talked about the prefrontal cortex, but the evolution of the limbic cortex from our most primitive brains on Earth to where we are now, and why that in itself leads to the personal contradiction we all live with the overabundant American society.
Well, we grew up in scarcity. That's the most important thing to remember. I mean, most animals are tuned to figure out a way of surviving in the rough. And so we have an old lizard brain, so-called because it's very similar to even modern lizards, but we shared that with the dinosaurs. Mammals came along, and they were characterized by caring for their young and developing this cortex. Now, that cortex has evolved over millions of years, and we are part of the primate species, and we have several other Homo primates which came before us, Homo erectus, Neanderthals, things like that. But we most recently developed in the last 200,000 years or so this lateral cortex, and also a much more efficient brain in many ways. Too short a time to go into that, but the interesting thing is that when we're faced with abundance, don't forget we grew up in scarcity. We don't realize that, for example, our next meal, all you have to do is walk down to the grocery store, mm-hmm. you know, and spend a few shillings, and you get as much calorie as you need for a whole day. As I said, and you mentioned, used to have to fight and run for that food. And so we are overwhelmed. We don't know what to do with abundance. We know what to do in scarcity. I mean, the interesting thing about our current meltdown is that actually it potentially is socially very good for us, because we're starting to think again. America has enormous entrepreneurial talent, enormous skills, enormous energy, enormous optimism. But we're now faced with something, I hope, that will force us into thinking laterally, thinking outside the box, rather than just wondering about, you know, what color should my next iPod be?
Dr. Peter Weibrow is our guest. 410-319-8888. His most recent book is American Mania, When More Is Not Enough. And William in Queens, New York, you're on the air.
Yes, Mark, what a guest. What an amazing guest.
He is.
I had a couple of questions, a couple of things came to mind listening here. First thing is that we always think that choice is a mark of freedom rather than confusion. And it's a little bit jarring to come to that conclusion that it's actually causing tremendous confusion. You know, this whole discussion reminds me of the fall of the Roman Republic. which was essentially a city-state government grappling with the distortions of running a huge empire, and it just couldn't cope with it. My question is this, and I'm happy to hear any comments you might have about the rest of that stuff I just said, but is there a chance in your mind that all of the crises we are confronting right now could prompt us to evolve somehow as a species? Or are we just destined for, catastrophe? That's kind of my question. I'll just sign off and listen. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Well, I like your framing of that. I too think sometimes that we're sort of into the Roman Empire. You know, the reason why they invaded England, which was my old country, is because they'd run out of tin and wood to smelt it. And so you can see the edge of the empire. We're now in Iraq and places because we need the oil. I mean, there's a great similarity. So I think that but coming back, are we destined for catastrophe? I like to think we are not. I mean, I'm basically an optimist. I guess as a migrant, we're all optimists who live here. And I think that we do, however, have to have enough of a shock to start thinking laterally, as I said. And that is what the current meltdown probably will help us with. My worry is that as soon as things go back to being reasonably good again economically, we'll begin to forget that we have to plan in different ways, and we'll go back to just enjoying the moment and creating a circumstance where we will indeed exsanguinate not ourselves necessarily but the planet. So that I think we have to be thoughtful about that. And you see, long-term planning is our great skill, but we don't really enjoy it as much as we enjoy that tiramisu I was telling you about.
But you know, you when you write to us about that, right in your just going back to the article for a moment, that you talk about the American dream being really dangerously addictive, and you write to say that America's productivity per person per hour is comparable to the most European nations, but our consumption is greater by one third. And here's the point that we all live through. You say we finance it by working longer hours, sleeping less, cutting back on vacations, neglecting our families, and taking on huge amounts of debt. And that probably speaks to almost every American listening to this show.
That's true. And you see, that's why, although it's fun to blame AIG, those guys were just basically doing what the rest of us have been doing. They're doing it on a grand scale. And so suddenly they melt down and everybody gets terrified because they're so tied into the international scene that they can't afford to melt down. Whereas when the poor little Joe melts down because his house he can no longer afford, or he's maxed his credit cards out and then suddenly loses his job, nobody seems to worry about that. But it's the same behavioral context in which we are finding ourselves. Everybody has been trying to grab too much too quickly, and therefore we have essentially mortgaged our lives into the future, and every now and again we are caught up short in the Great Depression, which is a little different from now, but it's a similar problem to what we're facing.
So if you can, in the couple of minutes we have left here, just talk a bit about where your thoughts have taken you about how we resolve this. I mean, where do we take this for our species and our nation?
Well, I have started to think about that. In fact, I worry about that. I mean, as our caller said, that's really the critical issue, is what do we do next? And so I think that it does come down to this whole issue of how do we develop a society with sustainable material wealth. That means that we are able to manage a planet that has finite resources, but we're able to live with 6 billion people on its face. And at the same time, think through what is the other wealth that we need to sustain a life which is fun. I'll give you one example. You know, we're all very curious creatures. That's one of our great assets. The curiosity, if we had more time, I would explain that the curiosity emerged because that was how we stayed alive. You know, if you picked up every rock to find out whether there's something you'd eat underneath it, that's curiosity, yes? And the curiosity is something which we love. That's why we love everything novel. That's why we like a pink iPod rather than a white iPod, because it goes with our outfit or whatever. But I think that the issue is how do you create a society where we are able to indulge that type of curiosity and, for example, social ambition. How do we create an opportunity for people to rise through a social hierarchy and to get the feedback that everybody wants, a feedback which says, we really are, you know, indebted to you. You are a wonderful person. And your last guest,
Wangari Maathai.
She has done. She's worked hard in the vineyard, metaphorically, all her life, and she is now revered because of the extraordinary things she's tried to do for Africa. That type of social reinforcement feeds the social ambition, just as well as buying a Mercedes.
Peter Weibrauch, thank you so much for joining us in this last half hour.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
You're listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Okay, we have to take a very brief break here. We'll be right back. And on our way out, it's a classic, Hang On Sloopy by the McCoys. Randy Hobbs of the McCoys passed away on this day in 1993.